Today on Maine Calling, nature's unsung heroes. Nature can surprise you. Some of the most unassuming animals and plants have a lot going on. Take the horseshoe crab. It's technically not a crab, it's related to a spider, and it has 10 eyes, each serving different functions. And this seemingly lowly creature actually is considered a keystone species for its importance in the food web and in helping its habitat. I'm Cindy Hahn. The wonders of nature are all around us, and some of the creatures and plants we dismiss or think of as pests have fascinating and often beneficial traits. The natural world offers lessons about survival, resilience, and the interconnectedness of all living things, including humans. Today we'll learn about a new book that highlights some of these underappreciated species, what they can teach us, and the surprising ways they interact with each other and us. Maine Calling is coming right up.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. We're talking about some of the unsung and underappreciated creatures and plants that are in our surroundings and why it's worth taking the time to study and learn about our natural world. Joining me today, Caroline Sutton, is author of the new book, Eyes in the Soles of My Feet, From Horseshoe Crabs to Sycamores, Exploring Hidden Connections to the Natural World. She's a former book editor and high school writing teacher, and she's also the author of the best-selling book, How Do They Do That? And also with us is Nathaniel Wheelwright. He is a naturalist and biologist and also an author and emeritus professor of natural sciences at Bowdoin College. He created a series of short videos called Nature Moments that examine the natural world more closely. We invite you to join the conversation. Is there any plant or animal that you think gets a bad rap? Have you taken note of anything surprising when you've been out in your yard or walking in the woods? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Caroline, congratulations on your new book. It's exciting, and it's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
And it's interesting. I want to hear a little bit about how it came about, because I know that the pandemic played a role in that. And it's kind of, that's kind of ironic, because one of the themes of the book is that something that may seem really all bad can actually have some benefits. So for you, there was a silver lining to the pandemic.
Absolutely. I'll say that I did start writing the pieces for this book before the pandemic. We bought our house out in Eastern Long Island in 2013, and I immediately began exploring. And I will say that curiosity really drove this book in many ways. A quick example is finding one of these largely unseen creatures, a horseshoe crab, on the beach, Bay Beach near my house, sort of half buried in the sand. And I picked up this, I was so surprised at the weight of this horseshoe crab. I picked it up gently and tried to look into the two visible eyes on the top. And I quickly learned that horseshoe crabs, which are ancient creatures, have 10 eyes. And that led me to start thinking about, well, how do other creatures perceive the world? How do they sense it? What's the experience like for them? And I think studying that, learning about that, can be really humbling and something I pursued. During the pandemic, in March 2020, my daughter, who lived in Brooklyn at the time, moved out with her one-year-old daughter, Ella, and her husband. And they lived with us for the next few years. So times certainly changed during the pandemic. Everything pretty much slowed down. We didn't go anywhere. So I might spend hours sitting on the grass with Ella, holding an acorn and taking off the cap and talking about that acorn. It was certainly a silver lining, as we developed quite a strong relationship to each other, but also importantly to the world in which we were living. Starting when she was a baby, and I'd carried her in the Bjorn down to the beach, and we'd say good morning to the trees.
That's
So.
wonderful. So that was the catalyst. And you mentioned the horseshoe crab. So, I initially thought there's a picture of a horseshoe crab on the cover, and I thought that it was going to be kind of about odd creatures and why they're interesting. But as you mentioned, it's about a lot more. So what were you really hoping to try to convey through the collection of essays that you put together?
I am trying to invite people to open their eyes, to alert themselves to their surroundings in novel ways, to follow their curiosity. One of the things I think happened with my granddaughter Ella living there was she often asked me questions, that I might not have thought about, and some I didn't know the answer to. For instance, she asked me why she noticed as she was growing up why do scallops sometimes have one pattern on one side of the shell and another pattern on the other. And sometimes, and I taught for a very long time, so I got used to the fact that sometimes you have to say, "I don't know. I'll go look it up," which I would do. And I was happy that she didn't actually want to spend the time on the screen learning about it. She'd say to me, "Lina, you figure it out and then come and tell me." So I think that it's important for us to, at this point, given the state of our world, think more about the agency of all living things, and not fall back by default, which we've done for a few centuries, on the human world being at the t humans being at the top of the pyramid, and giving less credibility to the creatures and flora and fauna around us. I think we need to change that perspective, that paradigm, if we're going to and raise a new generation with a different kind of awareness, if we're going to really try to solve some of these issues.
Well, Nat, that's a perfect segue to you because I'm sure those themes resonate with you. You've dedicated much of your work to encouraging people to pay attention and to appreciate nature. So, tell us about, I know one way you've done that is through a bunch of short videos called Nature Moments, and they're really a lot about what Caroline is saying.
Well, I decided when I had a sabbatical leave from Bowdoin late in my career that I could either write kind of an academic series of papers that a few people would read, or maybe this was the time in my career to see if I couldn't just help people get excited about nature in their backyard, very, very much like what Caroline is doing with her writing and has always done. So I decided, I think maybe another influence was, or actually maybe an example of something I didn't want to do, was sort of one of these spectacular nature BBC movies of wild dogs hunting in the Serengeti, or whales breaching and doing something spectacular. I wanted to look at the ordinary, the commonplace, the things that people could find in their backyard if they lived in the Northeast. So I decided to make 1 2-minute video every week in my backyard here on the coast of Maine, and introduce people to just things to sort of empower them to be observers and appreciators, and then ultimately defenders of nature. And I really had two audiences. I had my neighbor. I'm not going to name names, but sweet, I'll just call her Sue. What a wonderful neighbor she was. Just enthusiastic about everything, but not. Not a trained biologist. And then I had my colleagues who would, I wanted to entertain them as well. And so I'd tuck in a little something a little more nuanced or sophisticated or complex. And so I was really trying to reach both of those audiences with these little videos. And it was terrific. It was a great year. I learned a tremendous amount, got great feedback, and had fun doing it.
And we have a link to the videos on our website, but you want to share if people are looking for them, how do they find those?
They can Google Nature Moments Wheelwright or Nature Moments Maine Audubon. Yeah, easily found.
Okay.
And you can find them on YouTube, and you can find them online anywhere.
Well,
I will. Oh, sorry. One
I'm
of
just
them
saying it
actually.
was smart of you to make them 2 minutes because people's attention spans are really short now.
Well, exactly right. And I just wanted to tell a short little story. And one of them, for example, was how can you identify trees going 65 miles an hour on your commute to work in the morning in winter? Just give people a little, or how can you sex-a-tree as you fly by in your car, and just connect people as they go about their daily lives with nature around them. And of course, it was subversive. In the end, what I want is people to vote to protect nature and contribute money to help some of the wonderful NGOs we have in Maine and elsewhere to educate people about their wonderful natural legacy.
Well, let's go back, Caroline, to talk about some of that nature to protect, and that's the horseshoe crabs. I wanted to hear a little bit more of those, that you use them as an example of an unsung hero in nature. What did you learn about the creatures that was, you mentioned some of the fun facts like the 10 eyes and all of that, but that, you know, anything that was surprising and why we should care about them?
Well, the main reason I would say is they are a keystone species. Well, they're a number of things. A keystone species, which I'll describe in a minute. Also, their use, their medical use, which has ups and downs for sure. But we all are indebted to the horseshoe crab for its blood, which tests our medicines. But for very quickly, the horseshoe crab is a keystone species. The eggs of the horseshoe crab support about 25 migratory shorebirds. And the fish also, fluke and flounder and sea bass, all eat the larvae and fish eggs and the eggs of the horseshoe crabs. These are fish on which our fishing industries rely. They are also food for loggerhead turtles. So they're part of a very vast, far-reaching ecosystem, which we need to protect. At this point, horseshoe crabs are in critical state along the East Coast. There are five biomed companies which harvest the crabs. They've been doing this since the 70s, and they harvest them, they bring them into the labs and hang them up on metal bars. The photos are quite poignant, actually, and they bend the crab at the hinge of the back and puncture the heart and drain about 30% of the blood. That's a figure that varies on who you're talking to. The biomed companies say about 10% die when the horseshoe crabs are released. Scientists, including Larry Niles, a biologist who's been working very hard on this issue with the Horseshoe Recovery Act Coalition, would say higher, 30-40%. But it's very hard to track them once they're released. The females are often too weak to spawn again. Many of them are weakened by the handling, rough handling, held in bins. Their tails get, you know, smashed. So on top of that, there's another harvest going on, which is a bait harvest. I'm happy to say that in Maine and New Hampshire, the catch is so low that it's received de minimis status, so that the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, which oversees these numbers, doesn't even need to be involved really in setting quotas there. Still, in other states along the East Coast, it's as I say, the situation is critical. So fishermen harvest them for bait for eels and whelk, which ironically are also in decline. But there's something somewhat insidious, which the New York DEC actually knows about, but has not put a stop to, is something called dual use, where the fishermen lease the crabs to the biomedical industries. They know that the crabs are gonna die anyway, so they might bleed them more or even twice. And then they sell them back to the fishermen who then use them as bait. Well, their claim is that this means they're harvesting fewer because they're using the crab twice. The alternate argument really is that it incentivizes the fishermen to fulfill quotas or even perhaps go beyond. So it's a very difficult situation in New York. Last year, in 2024, the New York State Assembly passed very easily a bill to ban all horseshoe crab harvests in New York. passed with flying colors. Then it went on Governor Hochul's desk and she vetoed it. So the same thing has occurred this year. They passed the bill in the House, in the State Assembly, and it will go before Governor Hochul this fall. And we will certainly hope that she will sign it. Connecticut in 2023 banned all harvest, but it's somewhat absurd to have two very different regulations on the same body of water. And you can see that it might also invite Connecticut fishermen to come down to New York. So it's a very big problem because this is a keystone species and one we should be doing everything in our powers to save.
What's the definition of a keystone species?
Oh, it's a species on which many others rely for their survival.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Nat, I'm wondering, as you listen to this, the plight of the horseshoe crabs, what other species are suffering from this same sort of pattern that you can think of that maybe people haven't really paid attention to, just like horseshoe crabs? I don't think people pay much attention to them.
Oh, goodness, I was hoping you wouldn't get us in a dark direction.
Okay, I was actually going to ask you about lichen, but...
No, I will briefly tell you a little darkness, then we'll try to brighten it up. But
sure.
One of the things about being my age, I was born in 1952, is that you live long enough, if your eyes are open, to notice a decline in lots and lots of things. So... and then, of course, scientific studies, really careful monitoring, has shown that, for example, since I graduated in high school, we've lost 30% of all the birds. Pretty extraordinary. And then people about in the 70s started to notice that insects were declining. Just as a local thing, I used to go to the Sea Dog baseball games at night, and the night games would have the lights on and you would look up and see the moths flying around attracted by the lights. And then common nighthawks, a lovely bird related to whippoorwills, would come and snatch the moths out of the air. Well, if you go to games now, you won't see any moths and you won't see any nighthawks and you won't hear any whippoorwills. So there have been enormous changes in insect populations and in bird populations too. Now, just one more thing. If you lose 30% of the individual birds, you're actually losing more of your encounters with birds than you would think. And that's because when birds are provoked to sing by a neighboring male, for example, singing and intruding on his territory. So if you don't have a neighbor next to you singing in the morning, you get up in the morning as a bird and give a song and nobody answers and you say, good, I got that flank defended. And you go quiet. So the world is more than 30% quieter than it used to be in my youth. That said, in my youth, there were no wild turkeys. Now you can't drive 10 miles on the road without seeing them on the side. There were very few bald eagles, very few ospreys, very few moose. So some of these most charismatic species are on the rebound. And what it shows you is that if you are willing to take the steps to protect our precious natural heritage, you can make a difference in a very short time. So I'm hopeful that if, maybe in 3 or 4 years, we will have some good environmental, just continue our good environmental legislation, protect these species and be able, just like Caroline's granddaughter, Ella, to show our own grandchildren what we enjoyed in our youth.
See, you turn that from dark to light just like that. So great job, Nat. Thank you. We're going to take a quick break. We are talking about some of the unsung heroes of our natural world and how to protect them. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Many of nature's wonders go unseen, from what voles are doing below ground to how lichen can help create soil. Today, we're learning about some of the surprising marvels of the natural world. My guests are Nat Wheelwright. He's a naturalist and author and emeritus professor in the Department of Biology at Bowdoin College. He co-wrote a guide called The Naturalist Notebook. And Caroline Sutton is the author of Eyes in the Soles of My Feet, From Horseshoe Crabs to Sycamores, as well as the book How Do They Do That? She'll be speaking at Print Bookstore in Portland on October 28th. We invite you to join the conversation. What questions do you have about anything in nature that has sparked your curiosity? Email us at talk@mainepublic.org. You can comment on Facebook or Instagram, or you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And joining us now is Andrew Mackey. He's Executive Director of Scarborough Land Trust. Thanks for calling in, Andrew.
Good morning.
So I understand Scarborough Land Trust is the one that is sponsoring Caroline's book talk next week on Tuesday. It makes sense since what she writes about is very connected with what your organization does. So one thing that jumps out that we haven't talked about with her yet, but she writes about weeds in our lawns and how a weed is not necessarily a weed. And we need to treat them in differently and use less chemicals to get rid of them. So talk about how that connects to your efforts at Scarborough Land Trust.
Yes, absolutely. You know, of course, a weed is in the eye of the beholder. And, you know, what is a weed to many people is the lifeblood of the life cycle for many of these insects. And, you know, short-cut grass does not feed caterpillars, which turn into butterflies and moths. And so we have a program to really try to get the public to understand that leaving these spaces, encouraging native plants, getting insects in your yard will attract birds, will attract other wildlife. You know, it is all connected. And of course, everything you apply to your lawn ends up somewhere. And in our case, in Scarborough, we have this fantastic, the largest contiguous salt marsh in the state of Maine, Scarborough Marsh. And ultimately, most of that stuff ends up in the marsh, which impacts not only the animals that spend their entire life in the marsh, but animals that spend part of their life in the marsh and then the rest of it out in Saco Bay and the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, so another aspect I just wanted to ask you about, because we've been talking about taking the time to really observe nature closely, and you have places where people can do that in addition to the marsh. Where can they go and what might they see?
Yeah, we've been very fortunate to protect about 2,000 acres in Scarborough. You know, that might not seem like a lot in the grand scheme of things, but when you consider there's 80 land trusts in Maine and 2,000 land trusts in the U.S. and Canada, that starts to all add up. And here in Scarborough, we maintain 9 properties that have parking and trails that are open 365 days a year. And we encourage people to get out to see some of the things that Caroline has written about. You know, some of the life that might go unnoticed on a daily basis, dragonflies and beetles and bees, and not to mention, you know, the squirrels and deer and all the other wildlife that we're more familiar with. But all these small interactions that are going on all the time, and we do have lots of people that come out. Somewhere between 60 and 80,000 visits a year at our properties, including Pleasant Hill Preserve and Fuller Farm Preserve and Broadterm Farm and Warren Woods, just all these great properties that are for the public, are there to protect these things, but also, as Caroline wrote about too, during COVID, these were places for people to get out and get away from all the just pressures that life can bring. And I think we're seeing that again now, you know, with the federal government shutdown and all these kind of things in the news every single day. We need a place to go, escape some of that, put our phones down, and reconnect to nature.
Sure. Well, thanks for sharing all that with us. That was Andrew Mackey. He's with the Scarborough Land Trust. And Caroline, you know, he mentioned, you know, something from your book about weeds. And it was very telling that you had a whole definition of weeds being Was it plants that are in the wrong place?
Yes.
Tell us about this whole philosophy that there are things that are bad or they're pests, but they might not really be so bad.
Well, I'll start with weeds and with an anecdote. I was out pulling weeds out of my gravel driveway one hot summer afternoon, and I was thinking, I did this, that the clover actually looked quite pretty there. And I looked over at the lawn, and there were dry patches and some seeds where we were trying to grow something green. So the situation seemed a little absurd. When I looked into what is a weed, by common consensus, it's a plant that is in the wrong place. So clearly, an anthropocentric relative sort of definition. And then to add to the irony here, I went off and bought some flowers to plant along the edge and came home and found that they looked a bit like Queen Anne's lace. Brought them home only to find that, yes, I had spent $40 on a weed. It was yarrow. But going back to the, we can see how it made me question, why do we nurture some creatures and flora and fauna, and why do we kill others? In terms of weeds and lawn, there was an article in the Times recently about particularly some people in Great Britain who are abandoning the lawn idea and just letting weeds and flowers grow and enjoying the wealth of wildlife that that comes with that. And it's sort of interesting too, because the lawn mania and here initially came from England. So I'm hoping that we might follow, if this becomes a little bit more of a trend, this letting things go wild, because we're obviously, we're using a lot of our own energy. We're exhausted keeping them up. Plus, but the even worse, of course, is the amount of pesticides that go into those lawns. But as I said, we first started this desire for lawns back in the 1700s or so. We looked to England for many aspects of design, including lawns, which were generally behind walled gardens in England. So we brought them here, and by the 20th century, we sort of democratized grass. It was a necessity on the front lawn of any suburban home. And somehow you'd look down any main street and see continuous lawns. And in some communities, they still require, you know, grass of a certain length, and everything needs to look tidy. Well, tidy, yes, but to make that happen, probably killing a lot of the wildlife that would otherwise be there, insect life and so on. So I think it's great what Andrew is doing there with Scarborough and his work there to nourish all aspects of that ecosystem.
Great. Well, let's go to Robin calling in from Pembroke. Hi, Robin. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm Robin Hadlock-Seely. I'm executive director of the Maine Rockweed Coalition, and I was calling to mention a seaweed unsung hero today, which definitely belongs on this program. We Mainers call it rockweed, but the species name is Ascophyllum nodosum. And it's the brown seaweed that grows pretty much everywhere in Maine between high and low tide, anywhere that has a rocky shore. And when you look up the definition of hero, part of being a hero is having outstanding achievements. And we really feel that rockweed has these outstanding achievements, even though some people find its presence super annoying because it is slippery when you walk on it. But 100-plus different species use it, more charismatic species than seaweeds like otters and puffins and lobster and fish and shorebirds. And it's also classified as an ecosystem engineer, which means it's a species that significantly modifies habitat, and by doing that contributes to species richness and overall ecosystem health. So at the Maine Rockweed Coalition, we're about protecting this unsung hero, and thank you for letting me talk about it.
Sure. We love talking about seaweed on Maine Calling, so thanks for calling in, Robin. Great to hear from you. Nat, I wanted to segue to you as far as other sort of unsung heroes in the world of, gosh, I don't know if they count as a plant, lichen. That's something that you did one of your Nature Moments videos on, and it's sort of this thing you walk by and you think, oh, there's that smudgy stuff on a tree, and you don't really pay attention to it. Tell us more about why lichen is also somewhat of an unsung hero.
Well, I'm looking out the window right now at a bunch of boulders, and it's hard to find any spot on that boulder that does not have lichens. Graveyards are a wonderful place to go see a variety of lichens, and just in the upper intertidal zone on the edge of a beach are a good place on the trunks of trees. So lichens, which are a true symbiosis, that is the living together of two unrelated species of a different kinds of algae, blue-green algae, for example, and a fungus. I remember one of my Bowdoin students. Can I tell a quick story? What a lovely
Please
experience this was.
do.
Thank you. He was a student from Thailand who barely spoke English. And I'd ask, this is going to get us back to lichens. I'd ask each of the students to come and tell a story about natural history. And the student who had just arrived in the country stood up in front of the class and he had a paper bag and he said, I'm going to explain to you what lichens are because they are two different organisms. And he pulled out a little package of yeast, ripped it open, poured the contents into the paper bag, and then he had some dried algae from a Oriental food store, specialty store, put it in the bag, and then with an absolutely straight face, he shook the bag, and then he reached in and he pulled out a lichen. And everyone went, "Oh my God, you can tell a joke in a foreign language. That is good."
Magic
So that
trick.
it was like a magic trick. So I pilfered that trick for one of my natural nature moments. So yeah, it's just another there. I guess one other thing I would say about lichens is that they are very sensitive to air pollution. So if you go somewhere and you see that the trunks of trees don't have lichens, look around. You might have a factory that's producing pollutants or heavy metals or something like that. So they're excellent sort of canaries in the coal mine about our environment. And fortunately, I would say that in many, gosh, actually, since my youth, there's another good news story that air pollution has really been cleaned up in a lot of places. And so you actually do see a greater diversity of lichens.
So, would you encourage people, if they're taking a walk in the woods, to look for different kinds of lichens and also to let them be? Should you not mess with them?
Well, I don't think you have to worry about harming them in any way, particularly. I suppose if you stepped on them, that would be harm. But what I don't think I would, a beginning naturalist, I think I would save lichens for your next life. They're very, very difficult, especially what are called the crustose lichens, the ones that are kind of flat against a trunk of a tree or on a rock. So I've had difficulties with them. So I tend to go to the specialists if I want to know what the names are. But some of the ones that are called fruticose or foliose, they stand up straight like little tree, like the reindeer moss group. Those are possible to identify. So yeah, it's all, and if you can't identify them, what the heck? Just enjoy how beautiful they look and look at their interactions there. You can watch them kind of bumping up against each other, different species, and you see demilitarized zones where they fight for space and come to a truce. So anyway, lots of cool ecology going on and behavior at a very slow rate, I will say.
Slow and steady. Let's go to Patrick calling from Freeport. Hi, Patrick, go ahead.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to talk about?
So I wanted to share specifically about horseshoe crabs that you guys were talking about earlier. I'm a local filmmaker, documentary filmmaker, and I'm working on a film about horseshoe crabs. And in my research, I found that, well, along with the lines of the bleeding, not only is it bad that we're bleeding, but in 1994, a group of Singapore researchers discovered and created a synthetic alternative for the blood for the biomedical labs. And in November of 2024, U.S. Pharmaceuticals has approved the non-animal derivative of this biosynthetic alternative. And not only is it way cheaper at the dollar a test versus $16,000 an ounce right now for the horseshoe crab blood, but also it would be saving the horseshoe crabs because you would completely eliminate the need for bleeding.
Oh, so is this going to change? Caroline had talked about all the problems with the harvesting. Is it going to turn things around?
If the pharmaceutical companies start testing with a synthetic alternative, it should, in theory.
Okay. Well, thanks for bringing that up, Patrick, and for calling in. Caroline, what else do we know about this synthetic blood?
Well, it's it's less variable, the synthetic, than horseshoe crab blood. It's so there's another good reason to use it. The problem is there's no incentive really for the biomed to switch over, because they have these systems in place. And they're reluctant to change. For a long time, there were a lot of fees involved before the approval by U.S. Pharmacopeia in 2024. The approval had occurred in Europe and was started to be used there in 2016. It was much slower here. The FDA was nervous about it, slow about approving it. Eli Lilly actually went ahead before the approval by U.S. Pharmacopeia and began to pay to have the synthetic tested and put it into use. And they're now using it for about 80% of the medications they test, which is great. Others are a little slower to act. There's really, I wish that there were a government incentive here, because it makes total sense to change, and it's morally imperative, I feel, to change. But they're kind of sticking to their system, which also is not highly monitored. It's very hard to get a state-by-state number of how many are being harvested for bio. The companies are not eager to disclose that information.
Okay, clearly we could do a whole show on horseshoe crabs, but it's amazing what's going on there. So thank you for sharing that. We're going to take another quick break. We are talking about some of the surprising facts about our natural world. Our phone number is 800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. When you take a closer look at nature, you can discover some amazing things. What lessons can we learn from the animals and plants around us? Joining me to talk about that are author and former teacher Caroline Sutton, whose new book is called Eyes in the Soles of My Feet. And Nat Wheelwright is a naturalist and emeritus professor at Bowdoin College. Share your comments and questions. What unusual plant or animal or natural phenomenon are you curious about? Email us at talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or you can give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Let's go to Torbert now, calling from York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Cindy and guest. I have two items. First one is, if you go to McCoit Bay, there are public access points. In late May, around the full moon, you will see the breeding of horseshoe crabs, where the larger woman has given a free ride to the smaller man out of the depths of the ocean up to the edge of the littoral on the meadows of McCoit Bay, and it's an amazing thing to see. Second thing is the pollinators and all of insect life. No humans, the earth thrives. No insects, the earth dies. And the greatest threat to insects, and especially the pollinators, is our cell phones. The cell phone towers radiate in a frequency that is disruptive to the neurology of all insect life. This is not my opinion. This is documented by the New Hampshire Commission on the Health and Environmental Impacts of 5G, which can be found online. And they looked at thousands of studies and found that exactly that. And the phone companies are spending a huge amount of money bribing and threatening and cajoling public officials to keep this silent because of the money involved. Our cell phones are killing the insects.
I understand you wanted to make that point, but I also see from a note that you have a creature that you want to mention as one of the most fascinating that you think.
Well, thank you. The most amazing creature on the planet, in my estimation, is the octopus. While we have one barely functioning brain, the octopus has eight brains and has many other aspects of qualities that aren't shared by anything else on the planet. And the ancient alien crazies, of whom I am one, like to think that the panspermia came, life originated elsewhere and landed on meteorites on Earth. The greatest alien of all is the octopus.
Okay. Thanks for adding that to the mix, Torbert. Caroline, you wrote about cuttlefish and jellyfish and all kinds of creatures that have really out of this world abilities and traits that we can't even relate to, I think.
Well, one thing I'd like to add to that, I agree the octopus is phenomenal and we have probably a lot more to learn. But I want to branch off to something that got my interest, which is bioluminescence, because there are many creatures in the sea that we have not discovered that use bioluminescence, which is incandescence without fire. In other words, it's cold light.
They glow. They glow on their own.
Exactly. And some 1,500 species of fish, crustaceans, gastropods can use bioluminescence for many different reasons. It's a language of light, and I find this fascinating. A brittle star can discard one of its legs to distract a predator. The little psyllid fireworm comes up from the bottom of the sea to the top and glows to attract a mate. So in terms of language, I find it's very interesting because it's so abstract to us and we can't decode a lot of it. So I think there's a great deal to learn there and much that we don't know. And to think, as I said, about language and the fact that, for instance, if you think about bowhead whales in the Arctic where it's pitch black, their landscape is sound. When a cruiser comes through their boat or even air bubbles. So that's another way of perceiving the world that is so different from ours.
Thank you. So Nat, as we go into this season, this time of year, is there anything else that falls into that category of something that, you might think is a pest or that you might not pay attention to, but actually has some beneficial traits? What are you looking at around now?
Oh, so much to see, especially when the leaves drop and all of a sudden you can see the birds' nests exposed on the shrubs and the trees, and you can go see how they're constructed, their architecture. Soon we'll have a little bit of snow, I hope, and we'll be able to track mammals, which we don't tend to see very much. And I was going to suggest that for many of your listeners, that they do something that I am grateful I did about 30 years ago, which was to accept the invitation of a hunter friend, my good friend Rick, who's a dentist, said, Nat, you seem to be sort of, you know a lot about nature, but you don't really know much about deer, and deer are all around you. How about you and I go on a field trip? And I am so grateful for that because he showed me imprints in the leaves where two fawns had laid down that I could have walked right over, and little scrapes in the leaves and rubbing of antlers on the trees. And it's opened up a month of the month of November, which I have to confess I didn't used to look forward to. And now made me realize how much fun it is to go out and look at signs of deer. And it also opened up a conversation with people whose I won't say this is the case of my friend, but others whose political views may not be the same as mine. But here we have something in common we can talk about and enjoy. So, and I can learn from. So I would just say, go on a field trip with one of your neighbors who might be a deer hunter. Share what you know about the woods. Keep your eyes open for little teeny white insects that look like snowflakes. And those are woolly alder aphids. That's something else I love to look for at this time of year. They're just a white small insect, and they're dispersing from the alders where they tend to feed during the summer and reproduce, and spending the winter on usually a red maple or silver maple, maybe another alder. And then And then they'll begin to reproduce asexually in the spring, just put out little clonal copies of themselves. So that's something that you might mistake for a snowflake that you can go see in the woods right now.
So that's an interesting example, because those aphids usually are considered pests, right? And you're looking for them for their beauty. Do they bring benefits that people don't know about?
Just the resplendence of a small insect. That's the main benefit. But they don't cause any harm. They just feed on alders. Most people don't care about alders anyway. I actually like alders too. But if you look really closely at them on an alder, you'll see that when they are feeding on the alder sap, out the other end is coming a sugary mixture. And then you'll notice that ants are tending them and farming them as if they were cattle. And then the fungi are feeding on the droppings as well. And you see little lovely masses of black fungus underneath. So it's a whole world of interaction. Right in our backyard.
Just got to pay attention, right? Okay, let's talk with Scott, who is calling in from Kennebunk. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
I was just calling to give my definition of a weed, which I consider an unwanted plant.
Okay, so does that mean... for example, a dandelion?
Something in the garden that shouldn't be there. It's a weed.
Okay. All right. So would you call a dandelion a weed or clover?
No.
Okay. So it just depends on the person.
I guess it's a personal thing, yeah.
Right. Okay. That's a great point. Thank you, Scott, for calling in. That's something that you wrote about, again, Caroline, just, you know, all the different plants that, you know, nettles or things that you might find in your yard. Some people want them there and some people don't.
Exactly. I will add another definition to this one of a plant in the wrong place. Emerson said that a weed is a plant whose virtues have yet to be discovered. So he was quite generous, as he felt, you know, that every human had light and truth within, and he extended that generosity to weeds. So I think there's something said for that.
That's a great one. Okay, let's go to another caller real quick. Pam from Waldoboro. Hi, go ahead, Pam.
Yeah, hi. Hi, Jennifer. I am calling as a turtle rehabilitator. I've been doing wildlife rehab just for turtles for 10 years. And just from that perspective, I have a lot of anecdotal evidence of how, for instance, lawn chemicals really affect animals up the food chain. People automatically always assume that turtles don't leave their wetlands and that they just live in these little ponds. And we have 6 to 7 native species of freshwater aquatic turtles in Maine, and they all live in different kinds of wetlands. And I've had experiences this particular year where I've been trying to release incubated hatchlings back to the lake that they came from, only to find that the lake was shut to swimming because of algal blooms. And algal blooms usually happen because everybody living around the perimeter of the lake is using too much fertilizer in their lawns, and the nitrates run into the water and they cause excessive plant growth. So my problem with that is that I can't release the hatchlings in that pond safely or that lake, and I have to take them somewhere where their moms didn't necessarily come from, and that, you know, we always try to return turtles to where they came from. The other thing is turtles are out in lawns and meadows and fields and woods a lot during the summer, depending on the species. And they eat earthworms and they eat mushrooms and they eat all the things that are in our lawns. And like box turtles in particular are really susceptible to ear abscesses because of lawn chemicals. Mm-hmm. And those can become a huge chronic problem. And the last thing I wanted to say.
You know what? We're almost out of time, so I'm just going to let it at that. I'm very glad that you are doing the work you're doing with turtles. So thanks for calling in. I just want to squeeze in one more question to Caroline before we have to go. And Caroline, I know you mentioned your granddaughter at the top of the show, and bring that home to us. What do you need to teach children when they're young in their formative years about respecting nature or paying attention? What did you learn from being with her those years?
Well, I think we developed a complementary relationship. In fact, she one time said to me, "Lina, I see the little creatures under my feet. You see the birds and the sky." I tried to teach her that animals have their own agency, that a salamander might not want to be touched. she in turn had me holding bloated dead salamanders from the pool filter and bringing home a fiddler crab to spend a few days with us in the kitchen in a bucket. So I think that teaching a child that he or she is part of an ecosystem and not humans over here, the rest of nature over here, that they're connected is a way to see, to bring up children to see nature with respect and be a part of it. And
yeah.
I think that's really
great,
crucial.
Great final words. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us today. Nathaniel Wheelwright is a naturalist. Caroline Sutton is the author of Eyes in the Soles of My Feet. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. And tomorrow on the show, we talk with the author of a book on the history of sex ed and find out how it's taught in Maine. I'm Cindy Hahn. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.